Let me invite Mike Cohen to the front. Mike is the Herbert Bate Distinguished Professor of Medicine, Microbiology and Immunology and Epidemiology at the University of North Carolina. And as you know, a pivotal contributor to our knowledge on terminal prevention through the HPTN study that ultimately proved the efficacy of the intervention. Mike is going to talk about great opportunity, voice of caution, TASP, and the caveats.
Mike. Okay, thank you. Thanks for staying this late. I've got to say, I've given a lot of talks, but I'm the 23rd speaker on the same topic. And so I'm thinking, how is this even possible? 23 very smart people have all, and plus the comments, it's an almost impossible challenge. But I'll try and say something a little bit different for 20 minutes or 25 minutes. So what I'd like to talk about is first a little bit about how did we get here, and then where are we going, and how do we get where we think we want to go? So the first issue is the plausibility issue. How do we get in this room today? I would argue that there are three pieces of information or kinds of information that got us here. One is that lots of couple studies have been done. And there are actually 13 as of today couple studies. 11 of the 13 demonstrate a profound decrease in the probability of transmission to the partner of a host, in index case, a person who's taking ART. The two that failed to demonstrate suppression are challenged in terms of whether they had enough information about whether the person taking pills was reliably taking their pills. We have lots of ecological studies that you've heard about endlessly, and those are really important studies. They're mostly seemingly positive. There are some negative ones that I'm not going to summarize now, but we always beware confounding, and we mostly worry about generalizability. Is what we observe in one place really going to be generalizable to the entire epidemic? And then there's the one randomized controlled trial, which I feel I know intimately. I'll just say a word about that. So we had the opportunity with the support of the NIH and six different companies making antiretroviral drugs to study almost 2,000 couples at 13 sites in 9 countries. As everyone knows, we were able to show, at least at that time, that there was a 96% prevention of HIV when the ART was provided to a person with HIV infection who had a sexual partner for more than 3 months. And there was one lonely transmission event. This intervention, importantly, was superimposed on every other counseling message we could give. We didn't embrace a statement saying, you know, don't use condoms, don't worry about this. It was like maximal counseling and ART. The one lonely case has been a source of great consternation, and I just want to point out to you that we really think that the intervention is 100% effective. In PLOS Medicine, next month or the next month after, we'll report the one lonely case, and what we observed was a linked transmission from a person with HIV to their sexual partner. It was unequivocally the same virus. The sexual partner unequivocally seroconverted. But by using molecular virology and immunology, we can tell with pretty great certainty when the virus was transmitted, because we have the parent virus and the transmitted virus, and the transmitted virus accumulates mutations at a rate. So the computer says the virus was transmitted on the day that the couple enrolled in the trial. Now, obviously, that wasn't our intention, but nevertheless, what it emphasizes is that suppression is critical, that as you start ART, time is necessary for the antiviral to suppress the viremia, and so this one transmission event, we believe, can be ascribed to lack of viral suppression. So, and as we go forward with 052, which I'll talk about, I guess, in a second, realize that every transmission event we observe now in an observational trial we'll study with the same tools to try and understand how durable is this suppression. And that's kind of shown on the next slide. HPT-052 is not ever stopped. We were asked to make the results public, which we did in May of 2011. At the same time, we offered all the people who were in the control group ART at an early point in time. And I'll get back to that group in a second. At this point, about 95% of the infected people are still in the study. More than 80% of the sexual partners are still in the study. We're trying to understand the durability of the intervention and any consequences of delayed ART in the group that had their ART delayed. But remember, it's now mostly an observational study because we've offered ART to everyone in the control group. Now, one of the themes that I had the privilege, really, of hearing everybody's belief system. So I could have my computer and my slides, and I could keep making slides endlessly during the course of the day. This is my 23rd version of this talk. And having that luxury, what I can say is one of the belief systems that I will reject, and why not be provocative, it's the end of the day, and there could be no questions. We agree on that, right? We're done. No time for questions. I'll declare that. One of the belief systems is that people with high CD4 counts who are asymptomatic will reject taking antiretroviral therapy. I certainly think that's possible, and I think it's an important consideration because we see the same thing in every field. Somebody whose blood sugar is 200 and feels well is not anxious to take glucose control. Antihypertensive drugs are very hard for physicians to give, but over time we've done better and better at taking people who are asymptomatic with potentially life-threatening diseases and helping them to see the need to take the medicines. Adikon published a paper just recently about high CD4 count, arguing that one of the problems, and I can accept this, is that there's lack of social support and infrastructure that exists when people are sick. So when somebody's taking pills and they already sense a life-threatening illness, they have a much more support system. But I think the biggest problem is the mixed messages of our belief system. We've had 30 years of telling patients or people, take drugs, don't take drugs. Take drugs, don't take drugs. Take them at this CD4 count. Take them at that CD4 count. It's going to take a whole generation to give a unified message like we see in diabetes and hypertension. We had those debates 30 years ago on hypertension. We used to have mild hypertension and severe hypertension, and now we just have hypertension, and people are advised to take medicine. So I don't think it's fair for us to – I think we should worry about adherence at high CD4 count, but we need to get our message straight, and we need to feel secure about that message. And until that time, it's going to be difficult to get maximal benefit in this field. Look at the 052 study, which Awaf El-Sadr mentioned earlier. As we took people who were in our study, who were in the control group, and we told them when they entered, we didn't know the answer to the question of would early ART be of benefit. And then we said one day in April of 2011, we are now going to make drugs available free. And it took us more than a year of visits of the subjects to get almost all the subjects on treatment because they so strongly believed the treatment wasn't necessary until the CD4 count fell below a certain threshold. So again, I'll emphasize this is a field in dynamic movement, but I wouldn't pay that much attention to current beliefs of either caregivers or patients until we get our head straight about the message, like in any other field. Now, then we get into the when to start question, which can be the source of an endless debate, and I'll just kind of summarize where I think we are with this when to start question, because part of the issue about getting a message straight is conferring benefit on earlier ART, not just prevention benefit, treatment benefit. So the 052 study will publish all of its results in the next few months, and we see a benefit. We see a sharp reduction in tuberculosis. So in most countries don't offer a lot of prevention for tuberculosis. You can prevent lots of cases of tuberculosis by starting early. And then we see mild diseases offset at high CD4 count. So we always felt there was a benefit, and this is further confirmed in our subsequent work. We didn't find much harm to the drugs, and this is further confirmed in our subsequent work, but it's only 3 or 4 years of follow-up. In reality, this takes 20 or 30 years of follow-up to see the maximal benefit and the maximal possible harm. But what we know for sure from 052 and from many other studies is if you let the CD4 count fall, it won't come back to the, quote, normal level. You're not going to get 900 CD4 cells back. So in the people in the immediate arm, if you look at the upper red bars, we took people at a median CD4 count of 446, and they very quickly went to almost 800 cells, which is a very near normal level of cells. In the delayed group that we let to go to a median of 226, to my knowledge, almost no one has crossed 500. So by allowing the delayed group to be delayed, which we knew we were doing, we don't get the same number of CD4 cells back. Now, is that to the host disadvantage? It will take us many, many years to know that. But nevertheless, most people would prefer a CD4 level as close to the homeostatic level as possible. Now, we had a lot of discussion at this meeting about cost savings, and we'll publish a paper in press in the New England Journal demonstrating with the 052 data, you can say the following, that In South Africa, when we look at 052, it's cost savings for the first few years and then becomes very cost effective. In India, it's very cost effective. And these are complicated analysis conducted by Michelle Linsky using the CPAC data. And I think this is an important observation. But many people at this meeting have said another important thing, and that is we really need to look at cost benefit. As we compare use of ART for this population to prevent new cases, improve micro and macroeconomic function, and so on and so forth, we need to see how does that compare to spending money somewhere else in the health sector, and that's a very reasonable consideration. Nevertheless, I think it's secure to say that using the traditional cost-effectiveness analysis, that early ART is cost-effective. So we get into the final kind of denouement argument, and Lancet has a special issue coming out in November in which there's a few articles on this topic, one of which I had the privilege to write. So why would you treat somebody immediately? Well, first of all, we think there are consequences to ongoing HIV replication from the day replication begins. We think that there's reduced long-term survival, that you lose years of life if you delay ART. We think that we know there's ongoing transmission, that it occurs at all CD4 counts that can be averted. And we think there are both micro and macroeconomic benefits to earlier treatment. People are more productive, they're healthier, society is more optimistic, and so on and so forth. Why would anyone not want to treat everyone immediately? Well, there is anticipated detection of harm, and that's being studied persistently. There's search for benefit, and when I say benefit, I mean benefit at higher CD4 counts. But that benefit may not be visualized or seen for 10 or 20 years. This is a Framingham-level benefit, not a five-year study, because the benefits at high CD4 count are modest. There's an intense focus on logistical challenge, which I in no way dispute, but we can't mix up the logistical challenges with the best medical and public health goals we have. So we have to face the logistical challenges and do our best with them, and they've been discussed by the first 11 speakers, to my knowledge. And then there's START and TEMPORANO, which are ongoing studies, which will offer important information. But in my opinion, and I say this not to be dismissive, I don't think any finding in that kind of a study over a short period of time will change the momentum of where we're going. And I know Julio will shake his head vigorously to that one, because I've heard him argue about this vigorously. Now, observational studies. There are many observational studies of starting earlier, and I just want to bring your attention to the COHERE study. This was published last month. It's 1.2 million person years of follow-up. That can't be construed as a small study. And in this 1.2 million years of follow-up, if you just look very carefully, you see in this observational study, they see a benefit all the way up to CD4 count of 750. So if you look carefully at the study, you say to yourself, okay, how can this be completely wrong when they're seeing a benefit at CD4 count that high? That's a near normal CD4 count, and yet in that range of 500 to 750, they're still seeing a clinical benefit. So to me, early immediate therapy is something that can be very vigorously argued as part of our story. So then we get to guidelines. Lots of people make guidelines. Lots of countries make guidelines. And the guidelines are, who might we treat? Well, most people agree if there's a discordant relationship, a known discordant relationship, that the benefits of the infected person taking pills for their own health, as well as to protect the health of their partner, that that's become a standard. Many countries, and we heard from Malawi, yesterday, many countries use option B+ because they don't want to keep going back to pregnant women starting and stopping treatment. WHO has come out with CD4 cell count of 500, which is a fairly high CD4 count already, and then we'll get to acute infection in detail in a minute. So there's not many people left to not treat. There's not a lot of groups left not to treat in this context as we go forward. So then the next item for our discussion today is, will treatment actually serve as prevention? So I need to say quite clearly, the HB10052 study was not meant to be all things. It was meant to show the plausibility of whether we could stop a transmission event with antiviral therapy, and it turned out we only could demonstrate that plausibility in heterosexual couples. It was never meant to be a metaphor that this could end the epidemic or make a population-level statement. So we need to look at other data sets that would be of concern. The first piece of information we have to focus on is one that's come up over and over again, that there are special populations or key populations in whom we're not sure we're seeing a benefit. The most important thing is that in Australia and in France and in Belgium and in Holland and in England, in the MSM population, we're not seeing a reduction in HIV incidence or new diagnosis, depending on what they're measuring, even though ART is being vigorously provided. So Then we have to ask, why is this the case? And all the issues are shown on the slide. First, we never studied the ability of antiretrovirals to stop transmission when transmission is primarily focused on anal intercourse. We don't have the time today to get into all the biology, but I want to just point out one thing. This is a slide of the rectal mucosa, the first, to my knowledge, the first tissue slide in the entire meeting, so I'm very proud of that. Here's the rectal mucosa, and it's really important to recognize that the endocervical mucosa and the vaginal mucosa are much more resilient than the rectal mucosa. The rectal mucosa is very delicate, very friable, is very rich in receptive cells, CD4 cells. So one issue is that this tissue is so delicate and so inflamed chronically, and I don't mean to mean inflamed in a clinical way, it's got so many receptive cells, we need to be aware of that. The second point is the pharmacology of the antiviral drugs is unique in the rectum. It's different than in the vagina and the endocervix. And I put a reference on the end of that. So one possibility, which would not be happy, but it's possible, that perhaps the drugs we're using are not the ideal drugs to stop HIV transmission among MSM, or among those who participate in anal intercourse, which is not about MSM. It's a sexual practice. The other hypotheses are that perhaps men in these countries who are receiving antivirals aren't properly suppressed. I think there's not much evidence for that, and so I'm going to reject that hypothesis. The hypothesis we've heard most vigorously expressed, and I think has great merit to this, is that in the universe of untrusted or untreated people, that ongoing transmission is taking place at a proportion greater than would happen in the past, in perhaps because that group is using condoms less for a variety of different reasons. So these hypotheses we need to understand in order to deal with this problem. Now, we heard a lot about observational studies, and we only heard about one observational study. There's a lot of observational studies, and I would refer you to that Smith article I mentioned earlier from PLOS Medicine. But Tanzer's study has been heavily discussed, and we also heard that there are at least three large trials, community-based randomized trials, which are looking at HIV incidence as their endpoint. Now, if we really believe that we could treat our way very far forward and that the observational study by Tanzer was sufficiently compelling or perfect, we wouldn't be doing and spending all this money to prove to ourselves we really can see a benefit by treating more people. So then the question is, why are we unsure? Why are we unsure? Okay. The first issue is we have tremendous logistical challenges, which everyone has talked about. We've seen the continuum of care over and over, and that represents a huge logistical challenge, as does use of the best drugs and the cost of the drugs, and I won't reiterate what's been said all day long. But two other points that need to be mentioned, I think, and emphasized a little bit. One is the problem with acute infection, and the second is that history repeats itself. So let me first talk about the problem with acute infection. So every person who acquires HIV must go through this stage, a window where the virus is invisible that lasts for a few days when it's only in the tissue, a period of time where one or two viruses, a very small number of viruses, are acquired and grow at the maximal rate they can grow and achieve the highest concentration they'll ever achieve, hundreds of thousands of copies, if not millions of copies. During this window of time, there are three real problems, which we've documented extremely well. Problem one, the virus integrates into the host genetic material and forms a reservoir that renders this infection incurable. That's a huge problem for us, of course. Problem two, the virus goes to every compartment in the body, so there are reservoirs that we have not easy access to even as we try and move forward with better and better treatment. Problem three, people are maximally contagious, and the virus that came from somebody else to them can easily go to someone else. So we see clusters of transmission from persons with acute infection forming a star around them of more infections, or from acute infection to acute infection to acute infection. So we have three problems during that window of time. And then eventually, the host defenses start fighting the virus, and the virus reaches a set point. And we'll get back to the set point in a few minutes. So during acute infection, people are maximally contagious. Now, there's the reservoir first. So as the reservoir forms, you can interrupt the reservoir. So this is a paper by my colleague Nancy Archin, but there are now four other papers, all of which agree that if you provide antiretroviral drugs immediately during acute infection, that the reservoir will be smaller in size. And that might be very desirable as we move forward in the next 10 or 20 years. Another thing that we're concerned about that hasn't come up at this meeting is the reservoir size and acute infection. Oops, I go back. These are not independent of the people that we'd most like to cure. So while we're at this meeting, somewhere on this planet today, there's a Cure HIV meeting because this is a big topic. Now, the strategies are summarized by my colleague David Margolis, but there are many papers like this that point out a bunch of several strategies, most of which have merit, some of which have already proven that they actually can work. So this is not a static field. One needs to understand that as we deal with treatment as prevention, that another group are dealing with better treatment and another group are dealing with let's cure HIV. So our decisions about treating people with acute infection and earlier infection have huge implications, not just about prevention that we're focused on, but for the health of the host 20 years from now. Because the host that we, where we preserve maximal host defenses and we preserve maximal immunity and the smallest reservoir gives us a much better chance, I think, and I'll let Julio agree or disagree, towards different therapy 10 or 20 years from now. Now, there's another problem that's very relevant to the modeling and what we think is going on. And I'll slow down a little bit for this point. So the issue becomes this, that everyone, most people in this room are used to thinking about the idea that when that because of years and years of literature, that the CD4 count falls by 60 to 100 cells a year. And I would argue to you that what you're looking at is a tremendous selection bias. Because what's happened is the people you see to enroll in a longitudinal study of CD4 count fall have come to your clinic with a CD4 count of 400 or 500, and then you follow them and it goes down by 60 cells a year. But you've missed all the people with acute infection who had a very rapid CD4 count fall. There are three studies like this, there's one in development. But look at Novitsky's study of 77 patients with acute infection in Africa. 34% of them in their set point had a viral load of greater than 100,000 copies. So the first point is you're used to thinking of set points in the United States of 10 or 20,000 copies, but in Africa it's not uncommon to have a very high set point. And we saw the same thing in our own data set from the work called CHAVI. Now, in the people with a CD4 with a viral load of greater than 100,000, the CD4 count fall to less than 350 took 88 days, compared to more than 700 days in the group that did not have high viremia. What's my point here? These people are having very... This is one-third of all the people acquiring HIV infection that are removed from our discussion. And so when you do modeling and you start estimating how much you're going to eliminate HIV, if you don't understand all these acute infection patients and our failure to treat them, then your model becomes very, I don't want to call it spurious, it becomes limited in interpretation because you're not seeing this group. So here's an example of, and I feel more strongly about this paper, which is now 2 years old. This is a paper we published a few years ago in which we argued that if you were going to try and move towards elimination of the epidemic, you really needed to take into account not just chronic infection called CHI here, but acute infection as well. And that might be a very important consideration as we go forward. Now, people will say, and rightly so, how are we ever going to find people with acute infection? I have no idea today. But and it's not an option just to ignore the problem. A better idea is to endlessly think of strategies to try and bring these people into care, treat them early for their own health, for preservation of immune status and reduction of the reservoir, and to get a better outcome in this kind of a curve. So I would argue as I come to a close early, which should make you very happy because you're getting out of this room and there'll be no more speakers after me to my knowledge. So I would argue that this is a moment in time in this pandemic that has got a lot of excitement and enthusiasm because it's a bridging moment in time. We're really going from one kind of belief system and consideration to another. And I guess one of the most important points to make is to stop static thinking. Because a lot of times people will say, well, how can you give 40 years of tenofovir? Or how can you, you know, whatever. How can we move forward? Because the resources necessary over 25 years will be $18 zillion. That's really not, in my opinion, not the right way to think about this. Before 1987, there was no ART. And most of us, many of us at least, have worked on this our entire careers. So first there's no ART. Then in 96, between 87 and 96, there's one drug, AZT. Then in 96, as Julio pointed out, we got triple drug therapy. Then around 2006, this triple drug therapy became a single pill a day, which was rather revolutionary in terms of our ability to offer better and better care. Now in 2013, we heard from John Pottage earlier, who's developing long-acting agents, injectable agents that last 3 months or 4 months, and I have every reason to believe that some combination of these agents will be an alternative to daily pill taking. And there's a whole series of them, and there'll be others in the pipeline. And then who knows what we're going to see in 2015 or 2020. So if I actually believe there was no cure and nothing beyond triple drug therapy, I would feel very differently about what I'm saying today, because I'm really confident that it won't look the same 5 or 10 years from now. But then history repeats itself. So here is the danger. We've been here before. Most of us have been here in our lifetimes here. First, we were going to treat our way out of tuberculosis. So we had sanitariums all over the United States. At my university, we had a whole building devoted to tuberculosis with special lights on the ceilings and so on and so forth. But in the 1950s, everyone became optimistic we would treat our way out of the tuberculosis epidemic. In the journal Tubercle, which you can't find because they closed the journal with an editorial saying we're going to treat our way out of the epidemic. So that's a very bad sign. They committed suicide. So Tubercle had his editorial saying the streptomycin and we're done. This is the end of the tuberculosis pandemic. That wasn't quite correct. We've been there for syphilis. My good friend Alan Brandt wrote the book No Magic Bullet. You guys keep saying silver bullet. The book is No Magic Bullet. And he talked about Thomas Perrin, the Surgeon General in the 1940s, who said because syphilis could be treated with a single dose benzathine penicillin, we would treat our way out of the syphilis epidemic. And he did very good work and had some problems as well. But Thomas Perrin said that. And then the Chinese proved this was possible by literally treating their way out of a huge syphilis pandemic in the 1950s, virtually eliminating syphilis for 20 years. But now syphilis in China is back with a vengeance, and syphilis worldwide is pandemic. So we thought benzathine penicillin was sufficient, and we thought streptomycin and INH were sufficient, and that didn't prove to be the case. So what lessons do we learn at the end of today? This is my last slide, and then we will leave this room. It's axiomatic at this point that ART improves health. We can argue around the margins of whether it improves health most at CD4 count of 500 or 750 or 900, but it's axiomatic that it improves health. And it's axiomatic that the treatment of a person with HIV infection will block transmission very substantially, at least in heterosexuals and probably in other groups as well. I certainly don't want to leave you just because I'm not sure about anal intercourse that it doesn't work. It's just that we'd like to prove it beyond a shadow of a doubt. So then, but the AIDS-free generation that politicians and to some extent we talk about, it's an aspiration. It's not a promise. It's not for sure. We have these tools and this opportunity, but can we achieve that? So what is the challenge? First, there's got to be a lot of humility as we go forward. These other guys in the 40s and 50s were sure that they were getting rid of tubercles and treponemes. They were going to disappear, but they're still with us. So we have to go have humility, but we have an advantage. No pathogen has ever been studied as much as HIV. This is the most studied thing in the history of the planet. So that's a pretty substantial advantage going forward. Second, the lesson to learn from the 50s is now is not the time to say, oh, let's just move forward. Now is the time to redouble our research efforts and redouble our efforts to understand what implementation looks like. That's a mistake that these other groups made, that we can learn from them and redouble all this right now, not cut back on the funding and start arguing about, well, we're done, but redouble all this. Now, in redoubling this, we have to be smart. We can't study everything. We have to know what are the key questions to make this stuff work maximally and try and answer those questions as quickly as possible. Let me say this just right. I have had 25 years of funding to study HIV and genital secretions, and that led to the 052 study. But I personally don't believe that people on antivirals, regardless of the fact that they shed a small number of viral particles, that they remain substantially contagious. Those viral particles are defective. What's more interesting is it's a special compartment that we need to deal with to cure HIV. I don't think it represents a field of study important to the treatment as prevention field. So what I'm saying is we have to ask the right questions now to get the maximal benefit for what resources we have. My friend Debbie Birx knows I think PEPFAR is the perfect organization to answer a lot of these questions, the most important questions. Mao, those who study China will talk about Mao's long march. He walked across the whole country, and I think we should think of this whole test and treat thing as a long march, which is not going to be that easy. There's going to be a lot of ups and downs, and it's going to take tenacity and tenacity and more tenacity in order for this to maximally succeed. And what is maximal success? If we would reduce HIV incidence anywhere by 50%. That's as good as most vaccines can do. That gives the vaccine field a chance to breathe and try and develop a vaccine. So our goal doesn't need to be elimination of HIV, no offense to my friend Ruben Granich. Our goal has to be to make a very substantial dent in this, make people with infection healthier and live better lives. And if we do that, that would be a wonderful contribution of our generation, because the next generation is going to have to deal this as well, in my opinion. And lastly, I'll end by saying, you know, in this, failure is not an option. That's not something we can discuss. We must now realize the maximal benefit of the antiviral therapy and these 30 years of research. There's no option. So we must keep going until we get the maximal benefit out of treatment as prevention. So thank you for listening. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Come on, come here. There's time for a couple of questions. He's afraid. You see, he's
afraid. I am afraid, and I don't believe questions are appropriate.
Well, guys, go for it.
I have an opinion, and I'm really not interested in it.
Hello. Yeah, great talk. But as I look at this more and more, it's just becoming clearer and clearer, to me at least. Essentially what the world is suffering from is an epidemic of HIV stigma. That the biggest thing from the studies I've been seeing recently that stops people taking ART is terror of being seen as being HIV positive. And the second biggest thing is the perception that you only take ART if you're sick. And so really
I agree with you 100% completely. Those of us who practice medicine a long time remember that if your relative got cancer, they couldn't talk about it. It was, people were so, infectious diseases are very frightening to people. The airport's filled with drugs you can take so you don't get sick on an airplane. You know, there's a lot of magical thinking around infectious diseases. Unfortunately, HIV is an infectious disease. People were afraid of cancer, but they're not afraid anymore. So it's going to take generations before people see this as a normalized kind of infection. People aren't afraid of tuberculosis at the same level. It's not as stigmatized as HIV, and yet it once was. Cancer was tremendously stigmatized until it came out of the closet. That's not the right expression, but then they said, look, this is something we need to deal with. So I agree with you completely. The stigma thing is unacceptable. And the second point is, I agree with you about, it's just like hypertension and diabetes. Because you're not symptomatic, in my opinion, not taking pills threatens long-term survival, optimal long-term survival, and long-term health. That's just my, you know, not, there's still some fighting about it. And I'm sure if we stay here long enough, someone's going to go crazy over this issue. So that's why we got to get out of the room quickly.
Ken.
Mike, it was a brilliant talk. It's like good soup with the reiterations are even better each time. Just one point of, part of ongoing dialogue about...
I'll take that as a tremendous insult.
So part of our ongoing discussion about anal sex, so there are two other factors for MSM transmission that are really important. One is sort of the uniqueness of role versatility. Patrick Sullivan summarized this really well in a Lancet article last year. So men who have sex with men are uniquely able to be receptive and be more susceptible, but also can be insertive. And there are a lot of studies that show that contributes, and they even did a counterfactual to show that if that wasn't the case, there'd be much less transmission. And then the other issue is assortative mixing, that by definition, MSM have a smaller partner pool of partners, so as prevalence gets higher, you have a ping pong that increases incidence much more quickly, and therefore you have denser networks of acute infection.
That's agreed.
Final question.
Yes, I think I asked you the same question like a few months ago, but I don't expect the same answer.
I have the same answer, so why don't we get out of
the
room?
No, because let's stop thinking about Africa. Now let's move to Latin America, where most of the epidemic is MSM-driven. Because you sound very skeptical about the implementation, and many of us are using your study in order to support implementation, and then you're the main author, is very skeptical about it, so it gets a lot of confusion, like asking more questions to be into more research, and then the results be more questions and more research. So when do we jump into implementation? Because for Latin America, it will be about MSM, and then if you say not until we find out about the rectal tissue, so in Latin America?
Okay, wait. So let me clarify, because one can always be unclear, and I do speak fast and some degree of lack of precision. I'm in no way skeptical that antiretrovirals are essential for use. Okay. And I am quite confident that we can use them in ways that will reduce incidence in lots of populations. I do think that we need to be kind of transparent and not hyperbolic in terms of our expectations. So as we, and I do think research is important to measure the things that work and that don't work. For the MSM problem, which is, you know, which we're talking about, I think that the data we're seeing in Europe tells us we have to redouble our efforts to understand why we're seeing that information. So that's really what I'm saying, that I don't want to be like, we don't have blinders about what we're actually seeing. We have to take the data, understand it, and that's why I think all those hypotheses, Ken raised a good way of looking at it, and Valerie and her colleagues have talked about this as well. We look at all the information and we say, because we need to drastically reduce incidence in this population, and including in Latin America. So our job is to try and ask just the right questions as quickly as possible and provide the best possible drugs to get the best possible outcome as quickly as possible. Does that make sense? And I'm in no way skeptical. It's like we're going forward. Failure is not an option. But the issue is you can't just, it's not like a bulldozer because we'll knock down a bunch of houses and maybe not even knock down the right house. So that's where research comes in. And that research, in my mind, is both research to understand the biology in populations we haven't had to study, at the same time research to understand the pharmacology of the drugs we're trying to do this with, at the same time to understand the behavioral and social science aspects of all this, all concomitantly while moving forward. So does that make sense?
Let me ask you, Mike, just to clarify.
I want you to state your
position. What is your expectation regarding the impact of treatment prevention in the MSM population?
I think the goal is a minimum. For every population, the goal right now, in my mind, is a 50% reduction. And why do I want a 50% reduction? Because that's essentially what the vaccine field is looking for the next round of vaccines. So I think in our field, in the prevention field, short of vaccines, we should aspire to the same amount. The Tanzer study in Africa, in heterosexuals primarily, saw almost a 50% reduction just without focusing on acute infection or the other things. So the MSM population needs a 50% reduction as quickly as possible, and we ought to use treatment as prevention to achieve that. So I'm not skeptical at all about it. I'm not skeptical. I'm concerned that we do the appropriate research to achieve that goal, both measuring reduction and, again, I've said I won't repeat it. I could repeat it all again. Yeah. Can I have my first slide again?
Final
thank
question.
You. Thank you.
So it's actually along the same vein, and I have two things to say. One is that I'm not so sure that actually treatment has been deployed optimally in the northern countries that have been cited. So I think we're still using a less than 350, and people are waiting a long time before they get on treatment. So that's another issue. That's a side issue. And I also want to address the issue of, I think that we should be starting people for their own health far earlier. Let's focus on transmission. And the question is phrased in the opposite. And I would actually, I'm going to ask you, Mike, because you're the guy that just spoke, but I would actually ask the MSM community, how low would it have to be to not use it? So in other words, let's say that we do the RCT and we find out that it's only 30% effective in terms of blocking transmission. Don't you think that's high enough to use with condoms in order to block transmission? Or would it really have to be 96%? Or would it be 70%? Or would it be 30%? Or would it be 20? Or would it be, if it was only 5% effective, would we not use it? So I think we should frame it in the reverse, which is basically how low would it have to be in order to actually not use transmission, along with condoms, I want to add.
Let me ask you a question. So here's the point. A vaccine, I look at what we're doing as a community, as kind of the same as the vaccine field. We have a set of tools that we're trying to optimize to get reduction. Now, if we saw 30%, I wouldn't stop. I would say, can we revisit this, and what can we do better to reach 50? So if we saw 5%, I wouldn't stop. I'd say, why was it only 5%? What could we do better? Because I'm quite sure we can get – not quite sure. I would hope we can get to 50% in every population, which I think would be a great contribution for our generation of investigators. I don't know, Julio can add to that.
Oh, I would hope that we could get over 90%. I have every expectation. But in the meantime, I think we should get on with it because these people, everybody needs treatment. And so the prevention aspect is a secondary one, and we're going to learn by doing. And I think you agree with that.
I agree.
Good. On that note, have a good night.
Well done. Yeah, the 23...